December quarterly meeting of the Board of Regents to order. Welcome Curry and George. For those that couldn't be with us at the luncheon, honoring Beverly Davenport, who is receiving the honorary doctorate tomorrow. You missed a great occasion. It was heartwarming to hear her talk and recount what Western has meant to her over a long and distinguished career. So, with that, I'll ask for a roll call. Okay.
Chair Bell.
Present.
Regent Ball. Regent Brinkley.
Present.
Regent Brody.
Present.
Regent Dennison.
Present.
Vice Chair Milligan.
Present.
Regent Nichols.
Present.
Regent Spiller.
Present.
Regent Thomas.
Present.
Secretary West. Present. And Regent Formfeld. Okay, Mr. Chair, we have 10 regents present that represent the quorum of the board.
Thank you very much. We have had minutes from our third quarterly meeting on August 12th to review previously and first on our agenda today is the academic affairs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first action item is approval of the various departments. And I understand Provost Fisher is going to make a presentation in that regard.
Thank you very much. I want to ask that we approve five people to be emeritus faculty today. I would like to also introduce some of them. They are here today, so that's awesome. The first is Dr. Doris Sikora. Could you please stand? She's behind me. Thank you for being here today. A couple of things. Dr. Sikora joined WKU in 1998 and retired as the rank of associate professor at the end of June 2020. Dr. Sikora served as department head for Family and Consumer Sciences from 2007 to 2014, mentoring countless students. She gave more than 60 presentations to her credit and has awarded 50 grants during her career. Her service was at all levels of the university and outside the university, and she was bestowed the Kentucky Association Career and Technical Education Educator of the Year Award twice, as well as presented the KACTE Lifetime Achievement Award in 2018. Help me welcome her and say thank you. The second is Dr. Steve Spencer, who I believe is here. Dr. Spencer joined WKU in 1990, earned the rank of associate professor in 1995 and professor in 2001. He fully retired at the end of 2019. Through his career, Dr. Spencer focused on student success. Over the past three decades, he served as KRS, CHHS, and WKU in various roles, as well as outdoor recreation profession at local, state, and national levels. He was actively involved with the Kentucky Association of Environmental Educators, the Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife Services, and the American Alliance for Health, Physical Education, Recreation, and Dance. He was an active presenter at local, state, and regional conferences. Thank you for being here today. The third person who I believe is here is, correct me with the name, if she is here today? Dr. Katie Agilo, LGO, who was Professor of Environment, Earth, Environment, and Atmospheric Sciences. Katie joined WKU in 2001 and retired this past June. Dr. Agilo devoted many years of service to the continued pursuit of geography research in the Mammoth Cave region. Of particular note, the faculty of EEAS discussed how the work of Dr. Agilo and her former graduate students is the most loaded thesis ever housed at the WKU library system. She was committed to bringing to this institution GIS and was one of the first instructors in GIS. Thank you for your work. Professor in English. He joined WKU in 1998 and retired at the rank of professor in June of 2022. In his 27 years of service at WKU, he was deeply committed to student success and engagement. And one student summed it up: Dr. Hovitz's influence on his students. Well, the best part of Dr. Hovitz's class was that he didn't just focus on the coursework, but also focused on us as individual English majors. Dr. Hovitz helped students share their work beyond the classroom and broaden their horizons. As a colleague, he was irreplaceable. The true heart of the department is what he was called. Help me thank him for being here. And last, Dr. Glenn LaFantaise. LaFantaise. Wow, I missed that one. Joined WKU in August of 2006 and retired in 2020. In 2022, he served 16 years as the Richard Frockett Family Professor of Civil War History at WKU. He was the nation's leading historian on the Battle of Gettysburg. His prestigious writing career involved over 65 articles and edited volumes. Help me thank him for his time. So, if you would allow me, the next part is we want to again talk about research. And research comes in a large number of formats on this campus. And before we move to the person who is here to talk today, I was told today, or I was sent something that I would love to share with the group. I was told today that Dr. David Bell of English, who's a professor in English, if you go to the New York Times bestseller list, he's now the third leading selling book on the New York Times bestseller list in the young adult area. If you want to read the book's title is She's Gone. But that's a great feat, and it's one of our own faculty, and that just tells you how good a faculty we have at this institution. And let's say thank you to him, too. Having said that, it's a pleasure today to have Joanna Malincon.
Before we do that, we may want to. We need a motion.
Oh, that's my fault. Sorry.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Provost Fisher. Excuse me. We would now entertain a motion for the approval of merit status to be awarded for the recommended individuals.
So moved.
That such a motion?
Yes, so moved.
Regent Spiller moves.
Second.
Denison seconds.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. The next item is an information item, as Provost Fisher just alluded to, from Dr. Joanna Malincon.
So she's a professor of marketing and the director of the MBA program at the Gordon Ford College of Business. She currently teaches marketing research, social media marketing, and consumer behavior. Her research interests include consumer loyalty, non-traditional advertising media, and consumer complaint. And I'd love to have her come up now and give her talk.
I'm from South Louisiana, and I was really surprised to hear the mispronunciation of her last name.
I said my husband's family. When they moved to Memphis, nobody could say it the right way. So the more fun way. So Malincon is how we hear. Thank you for having me today. I'm excited to tell you a little bit about my research. My most recent research looks into boycott calls on social media, especially in response to brands taking a political or a social stance on an issue that consumers don't like. Social media in general has been an interest of mine right when I started my career at Western, is when we started to realize social media was going to have an impact on marketing, but I don't think anybody understood the extent to which social media was going to completely revolutionize everything we do in marketing, and I think in business in general. And marketers had to learn very, very quickly how to use social media as a tool to communicate with consumers. For a lot of products that or media that are used for marketing and advertising, we had decades to figure out how to use those tools before a lot of people adopted them. With social media, it was years. And now sometimes when a new platform comes up, it is months that we have before we have a large number of consumers on these platforms talking about brands. And we're happy when consumers talk about us. So about 2.4 billion conversations take place that mention brands on social media every day. And we know that when consumers say good things about us, that that's 9 times more effective than anything we can ever say about ourselves. So we like word of mouth. We know that it works. And social media was the first tool we had where we could actually measure and see exactly how far word of mouth spread, exactly how many impressions one thing a consumer said about our brand went. The issue is that, for the first time, consumers could also talk back to us while we were talking to them, and we didn't always like the things that they were saying about the brand. And so marketers' number one fear has always been the negativity consumers may show about the brand on social media, as well as losing control of this brand message so carefully crafted that can very quickly, in a 144-character tweet or a 15-second TikTok video, be undone and seen by millions and millions of people. Because before, if you were mad, you could probably tell about 30 of your closest friends, and now it's potentially hundreds of thousands to millions. We're also in an interesting place with our target demographics and the political environment in this country. So younger consumers especially, but also older consumers as well, want to buy brands that represent their values. And Gen Z and millennials especially think it's not only important to know where a brand stands on a lot of issues, but also to know what the brand is doing to support that issue. And so that's younger consumers especially. At the same time, if consumers don't like the stance you take, 59% of them will say, well, we'll boycott the brand. So you think, okay, that's fine, brands just choose an issue that all your consumers are okay with, but we're in a very divisive political environment where almost any stance you take, about half of the people will disagree with whatever you do. And so this led into this research project that I've been working on, which looks at boycott calls on social media, conversations about boycotts on social media. And so what we did is we went and found 8 pretty high profile calls for boycott on social media, and we were careful to look at both left-leaning type boycotts, when the CEO of Goya supported President Trump in a speech at the White House, and right-leaning boycotts, like when Nike used Colin Kaepernick to represent the brand. And for those eight total events, we gathered the first 100 tweets that happened after that event started the call for the boycott. And we use qualitative research, which means just really reading through 800 of these tweets and really trying to understand people's motivation and why they would enter into this discussion of boycott calls on social media. And I won't go over this all, but this is the framework that we came up with. But what was especially interesting is we expected to see a lot of people talking about boycotts and why you should boycott a brand. And they had differing levels of motivation, from they just wanted the brand to change their stance to they hated the brand and hoped the brand went out of business and were very, very, very angry at the brand. So we expected to see that kind of thing from the pro-boycotters. But what we also found that was new was that just as many people were entering into the conversation using the boycott term and tagging the brand that were defending the brand. And the motivations were very similar for both the pro-boycotters and the anti-boycotters. And we saw all of these themes and motivations for both left-leaning and right-leaning boycotts, as well as across all of the different types of brands that were represented in these 8 cases that we looked at. And so this is a first step, understanding this is what the conversation looks like. What I'm interested in next is what is the short or the long-term effect on these brands in terms of attitudes toward the brand, but also in terms of performance, stock prices, sales? Because there's mixed reviews. A lot of people, we assume that these are all very, very damaging for brands, but a lot of what the news is telling us or what the actual results are telling us is that it may not be that much of a long-term impact. And I'd like to know how the presence of these pro-brand voices influence the performance. So when you have a lot of people that are defending the brand and doing all the things the brand should be doing, but they don't have to defuse the boycott because your consumers are doing it for you and you're not spending any resources in the brand doing that, that's ideal. And I'm curious how that actually affects the performance of the brand. And I have to mention, these are the people that waded through the 800 tweets with me to figure out what in the world we thought people were saying or wanted. And this research has been published this year in an academic journal, and we're working on the next step. Thank you. I know you have a busy agenda. If you have questions, I'm happy to answer them. If not, that's okay too.
Kerry, you up there?
Thank you very much, Doctor. Do we have any questions or comments at this time?
Elon Musk might be interested.
So I should have said we collected these tweets before Twitter started doing what Twitter is currently doing now.
Yeah, I recently saw where people were going out to buy Teslas to help him.
It's called boycotting. And so that happens where people propose that they're going to buy more of the product.
I don't have that kind of disposable income.
No, but...
I did have a question, not on this, just as someone, and Dr. Melanchon and I came in at the same time. You arrived in 2006, we arrived in the College of Business together. I've tried to describe to my colleagues on the board how our jobs have changed, and so just to get an opinion from you, how has your job as a professor changed over the last 3 years?
I find that students are coming to me less prepared than they ever have been, and in some cases less motivated too. And I think that they just have a lot of other things on their mind. And so it's become not only teaching marketing, but listening to the issues that they're having and trying to find ways to re-engage them, because the things that we used to do that don't necessarily work anymore. So I think it's a more challenging job than 3 years ago. Probably most jobs are more challenging than they were 3 years ago, but this one's one of those.
Interesting. One of our journals recently had an article alluding to that a bit, but saying, you know, a good question to ask students is, what do they think the purpose of college is? What do we think the purpose of college is? That's discussion.
We know pre-pandemic, fully a third of our entry class likely came to us medicated for some sort of mental health challenge, either social anxiety, depression, and the 2 years of the pandemic just exacerbated that. And so I say that because we know the massive challenge that we have around everything that has nothing to do with instruction. And we'll talk a little bit about that in the context of the MedCenter Health contract, but that's an important thing for us as an institution to grapple with, to ensure that we have resources for young people who are struggling outside of class to, number one, know the resources exist, number two, take advantage of the resources and not feel any jeopardy because of it, and the third is making sure that we create the bandwidth for them to have that kind of support and treatment.
And I certainly didn't mean to take away from your research presentation, but I know. Dr. Melanchon is one of those professors who cares about her students and is there and is doing her research. And so just to get a perspective, someone who's able to do all of those things and understand how that adds to the work and the burden. So.
Chair Melkin, thank you for adding this element onto our meetings.
presence of Boney decided to do that. It's really nice having some of our professors share their research. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Melgott. We certainly appreciate your presentation. That concludes, I guess, the academic affairs portion of the agenda today.
Thank you. We'll move right on, and we do have a busy agenda today, so we're going to try to keep things moving. And finance and budget is up next, chaired by Regent West.
Hey, thank you. Yes, we do have several items on the agenda, so we will try to move those as much as we can. And Susan, you're going to talk ahead about all of this.
So one of Chair West said one of the things that I'm loath to bring things to the full board before they go through committee. There are several action items that you will see today that because of timing, the audit not being prepared, that still needing to be approved, our need to ensure we're able to deliver healthcare on campus in January, and thirdly, some late but welcome action by the BEC to make a recommendation to us just 2 days ago, around increase. I thought it was important to get in front of you quickly, so my apologies for not having followed the committee process, but on those items, I thought it was important for us to take immediate action to be able to have health care support our faculty and staff.
So that's just all the items we have, so it is a busy agenda, Regent West. First, we have the FB1, which is the acceptance of the auditor's report. This is their time to talk to you as a board member, so I just want to say a couple of clean audit, no audit findings, which is outstanding, especially since we do have a new audit firm, and there was also some a difficult GASB standard, which got a lot of universities this year. I will turn it over to our new auditors. They were formerly BKD, was merged with another firm, and they are now Forvis. I had the pleasure of working with them at my prior institution. So we have Mary McKinley, who is a partner with the firm, and Jennifer Williams here to present the audit findings to you.
Well, thank you for having us here this afternoon. We're pleased to be able to present the audit results and findings to you. And actually, you'll see good news in all of these reports. So that's always a good message for a rainy afternoon, right? We are Forvis, and we formerly were BKD. We merged in June of this year with another firm. So Forvis is our new name. Somebody asked, well, what's that mean? Forvis is a combination of two words, forward and vision. So Forvis. And so that's been kind of, we're getting used to our new name, but it does mean that we're the eighth largest CPA firm in the country. And so we're just thrilled to be able to bring resources to Western, especially in our technical areas and consulting, et cetera. Jennifer and I are here today to talk a little bit more about the details of the audit report. For that, I'm going to turn it over to Jennifer.
Thank you, Mary. And thanks, Board of Regents, for allowing us to be here today to present the annual audit results. So I will try to move these through as quickly as I can, as you know you have a full list of that. So I have the audit results to present to you today. A few financial statement highlights, as I know the audit report is rather lengthy and continues to have more pages with new footnotes and standards. Then I do have our required communication letter to you today, and then if there's any questions. Excuse me. As Susan mentioned, we did accomplish the audit plan and the timeline. This was the first year with Forvis. So with a first-year audit firm, we ask a lot of questions. So we have to get acclimated to the university, make sure we understand the processes and the controls. So there are a lot of additional questions and timing from that aspect. And as Susan mentioned, we also had GASB 87 to adopt this year. So this was one of the probably largest most recent GASB standards after GASB 68 and 75 with the pension and the OPEB. So 87 is regarding leased assets. And so there was about a $32 million change on the statement of net position regarding this. And so really with GASB 87, there was a lot of work that management had to do to look at those leases, what met the definition, and so that did cause quite a bit of time to go through that. So again, just want to thank Susan and Ronaldo and Christy and their team. They worked very hard with us as a new audit firm and to get this standard, and they had the hard work of going through all those leases, all the documentation, so I really want to give the kudos to them for that process. So we did have an unmodified clean opinion. We do have an emphasis of matter, so when you generally adopt a new standard, if there's a significant activity or change in the financial statements, we just note an emphasis of matter so that it makes a reader aware that we did adopt that standard, the university did. There were no significant deficiencies or material weaknesses in internal controls in the financial reporting or on compliance. One thing to note with the adoption of GASB 87 is the financial statements are shown in a single year presentation versus a comparative, and that was due to the way the standard was written and how you were required to adopt it. And so it impacted the effective date depending on how many years you showed in the financial statements. So no issues or concerns, but it did help with the adoption and being able to show that in a single year presentation. A few financial statement highlights that you'll see here. So net tuition, you had a slight decrease of about 6.65% from 102 million to 96. Again, we see this consistently along universities, again, just with coming out of this post-pandemic, getting students back on campus and the change. So a slight increase there. You'll see the net position is very strong, increase from 62 million to 123 million. And then your state appropriations there, you'll see went from 71 to 78 million. So again, state appropriation going into that net position number. This slide here just gives you a summarized financial highlight. So these are taken from the full audited financial statements, but gives you a summary of the statement of net position. So you'll see here a few highlights. Cash decreased about $10 million. Again, this is just less collections on tuition and then the use of federal funds that would have been provided through the CARES Act and various funding there. You will see added the lease assets net, so you'll see the $32 million that I spoke about, but then you'll see the capital assets net decreased about $23 million. So really the impact was activity on the statement of net position, that instead of capital assets, they are lease assets, so it's a lot of terminology change there. So then you'll see total assets and deferred outflows, again, $644 million at the end of the year. There in the liability section, again, you see the lease obligation. So again, you have the asset and the obligation are very similar. So you see the decrease out of the notes payable because that was reclassed into the lease assets based on the terminology. The pension and the post-employment benefit liability. So this decreased about $46 million due to changes in assumptions. So this will always fluctuate depending on assumptions, rate of return, investment, different various items that go into those actuarial calculations for that. Next slide here just shows some of the financial highlights for the statement of revenues and expenses. So you'll see again the federal and state grants did increase $5.6 million. This is still increasing from the Higher Education Emergency Relief Fund and other funding that has been awarded to the university. The operating revenues, they'll see about a slight increase there to $146 million compared to total operating expenses of $253 million. So again, those went up about $16 million. Again, different expenses related to increases in costs and various items impacting the university. Those are offset by the state appropriations and those items that are called non-operating revenues on the financials. Here are just some highlights on the footnotes. So there was a new table in the footnotes for the GASB 87 presentation. We did have to add the disclosure of the lease obligations. And then there was a note 16 that disclosed a subsequent event with the issuance of the bond. So that did was needed to be disclosed in the financial statements as a subsequent event. We do the single audit as well for the uniform guidance. So we did have no findings, as I mentioned, on that. And those programs that we did test were the Student Financial Assistance Cluster, Education Stabilization Fund, HERF reporting, and the Research and Development Cluster. Any questions on those items from the financial statement, in fact, until I go to the letter?
All right, so the Board of Regents letter, this is our required communication to you today. So here is just to acknowledge that we give you an unmodified opinion on the university's financial statements, and these were the standards that we were required to follow in that presentation. Here's the significant accounting policy. So again, this is GASB 87, and these are included in note one in the financial statements. We did not identify any alternative accounting treatment during the audit process. And then this slide shows the management's judgments and accounting estimates. So estimates are included in any financial statement. So these are items that we looked at in particular in the financial statement audit process. No items or concerns noted with these, but we look at those assumptions going into the actuary reports for the pension and the post-employment benefit liability. We look at any allowances for uncollectible receivables or pledges, those types of items. And then with GASB 87, we had to look at the assumptions management used for the discount rate and low lease terms, and lease payments, those items that would impact the value that was recorded on the statement of net position. We've already talked about the financial statement disclosure changes with GASB 87. The other item was audit adjustments. So we had no audit adjustments that were proposed by Forbis and recorded by management. So very good kudos to the team there on getting the financial statements prepared. We did have what we call free past adjustments. So these were items that we identified that we deemed that were not material to be recorded on the financial statements. And this will be very, very small, so I apologize for that here. The very top item is an item that we noted is just a reporting item where you reclass between an asset and a liability on a negative cash balance. This is one that most universities and other businesses do not record, so we just acknowledge that this should be a difference between an asset and a liability, but is not any error in recording of any balances. The second item here relates to fixed assets. So as new auditors, we did something with the fixed asset in those items. Again, this was about $3.8 million. This was just a process that we had looked at, and this was an accumulation over time of just more depreciation being expensed than should have. And so when we looked at that, everything was corrected during the current year. So during the current year, management updated those numbers. So all we're acknowledging here is technically that number should have been higher in the given year because they decreased it to correct that. So again, that is what we call as, again, just a past adjustment for that. And then the third item related, this was about $2 million. This related to GASB 87 adoption. So anytime when you adopt a new standard and you go backwards and you start looking at agreements, we looked at some assumptions and timing was different. So something should have been amortized, say, maybe by 15 years and it was amortized by 10. So again, this was just recorded in the adoption of GASB 87. Very common item when you go backwards and start looking at how you make decisions. So these are, again, items that we say when you look at all these collectively, they are not significant to the financial statements. And that is really illustrated on this slide as well. When you look and I talk about your change in your net position being about $60 million, if you would include these in the financial statements, only has about a 6% impact to the financial statements of the book. So again, that was about $3 million. So again, we don't deem these material, and so we talked with management, did talk to the board before we released the financial statements to make sure everybody had agreed upon this. Then here again is the final item. So then again, we looked at the accounting policies related to 87 and how the Higher Education Emergency Relief Fund was handled during the year. And then we have what was attached to this letter is the management representation letter. So as we complete the audit, we have management sign that for us as we wrap up the audit process. So those were the prepared comments I had. I know that was a lot of information. So happy to take any questions.
I have a quick comment. As one of the groups on campus that's audited annually, my colleague in finance and compliance has been extremely complimentary of the amount of interaction and thoroughness, almost exhaustive thoroughness. She's very excited about that. In your world, I'm sure that's a good thing. But I just wanted to pass that along, that we have seen great things so far, and I have no negative comments. I think it's a much more thorough process than I've been involved with previously. So thanks.
Any other questions or comments?
I'd like to congratulate Susan and the team. It's not easy coming off of the last couple of years and going to an audit with a new firm and coming out with something this clean, so I'm pretty impressive. So congratulations. To you too, Jim, because I know how you feel going to be too.
I'm just pleased that we have a new set of eyes to help make sure we're on the straight and narrow.
Much appreciated. Okay, any other questions or comments? If not, then I will ask for a motion to accept the auditor's report and financial statements.
So moved. Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion passes. We also will move on to our next item. Susan, if you could, it's the approval to a revision of the 22-23 operating budget.
So this is a revision relating to carry forward, and so I just want to go through some of the highlights of this adjustment. So this allocation is based on the policy that was revised January of 21. Provost and I are currently working on yet another revision to align better with our new budgeting process in RAMP. So just to remind you, the policy exempts the following categories from a carry forward calculation. Those would be auxiliaries, your housing, your parking, your dining, course and program fees, direct state appropriations, doctoral programs, FNA, graduate research, your FUSE and RECAP grants, and your distinguished professorship awards. And basically, carry forward funds are just when revenues exceed expenditures, and they have budgets that are left at the end of the year that are carried forward into the new year. We do not allow the units to use these one-time funds to fund permanent obligations. That's incredibly important for the board to understand. Any type of permanent person or permanent expense has to be funded with ongoing funds. So this is what the adjustment looks like. The exemptions that I talked about, they totaled about $24.6 million. And then the non-exempt, $4.6 million for a total of $29 million. So I will note, part of the issue around this carry forward amount, which I've spoke with Jan about, and we're trying to work through a way to get around this. Because we're the carry forward dollars go back to the unit so late in the year, a lot of times they go unspent, and so they result in carry forward once again. So what we're trying to do is look at a way that we might be able to bring it to the board earlier in the year and get it in front of you so that the deans and vice presidents can have their funds to use earlier in the academic. But that's for next year.
Thank you. Anybody have any questions? Comments? Hearing none, then I will ask for a motion to approve the revision to the 22-23 operating budget.
Second.
All those in favor say aye. All opposed? And we will move on to our action item 3, which is approval of personnel.
So I don't have anything additional on that. That was presented to the board at the October meeting. So this is basically a consent agenda item. So unless you have any questions, there's no change from October.
Okay. Anybody have any questions? A motion to approve the faculty and staff personnel actions.
So moved.
Second.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay. The motion passes. We have our next item, which is FB4. It's the approval of the budget versus actual report.
So again, that was presented to the Finance Committee at the October meeting. There's been no changes to the report since then. So I'm happy to answer any questions, but there's been no changes since the audit report. Any questions or comments? Hearing none, then we will ask for a motion to approve the budget versus actual report.
So moved.
Second.
I'll yield the doors.
All right, thank you. And all in favor say aye. All opposed? And then the motion passes. And then we'll move on now to our number five action item, finance and budget, and that's the approval of a line of credit with Truist Bank, or it's really the renewal of the line of credit. So again, this was presented to the Finance Committee at the October meeting. The only thing I do want to reiterate is that it is a renewal of the line of credit. It's not a new line of credit. This is best practice. We've never had to, for 3 years, we've had it in place and never needed to use it. It's basically a safety net. You don't want to go get a line of credit when you need one. So this is just there in case we need it. So.
The renewal of the line of credit or comments? No.
So moved. Second.
Very good, Gary. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Okay, the motion passes. And our next item was not on the committee agenda. This was something that needs to be approved at this meeting, and that is the health services.
So again, as the president alluded to, the reason it was not talked about at the October meeting, we were still in negotiations. And so I'm going to turn this over to Jennifer Tugas. She's our AVP for Business Services. She led the RFP process. She did a great job. Congratulations. And she'll do the presentation, and I'll be sitting back there if you have any questions for me. So Jennifer. Okay, thank you. Good afternoon.
This has definitely been a long time coming just in terms of the RFP process itself. We did start the process pretty much in the summer of last year when we hired consultants through the American College of Health Association to assist us with that process because we didn't necessarily have the medical expertise in-house, you know, to help us guide us through that process. And they were very, very helpful through that process. And what we began with is some stakeholder engagement in the fall of 2021. We had some on-campus meetings. And through those meetings, you know, talking with the stakeholders across campus, a few themes emerged. You know, they're kind of, once you get into three or four meetings, when you start hearing the same thing from different groups of people, you know, there's a common thread that emerges. And so one of the things I was telling Regent West about as we were preparing for this meeting was that regardless of who the vendor would have been selected at the end of this process, the RFP process itself was positioning us to be in a better place in providing student health services on campus. We developed a robust RFP that we released in the spring of 2022 with presentations later in the semester. Unanimous selection in the summer of 22 and the contract negotiations continued through the fall. MedCenter Health was the vendor that the group selected, and a lot of the strengths from their proposal, they were most able to meet all of the requirements of the RFP as a whole. And the strengths of the sports medicine program was certainly a part of that. Strengthened an approach to providing care. Their approach was having the same set of staff present on a daily basis, so it didn't matter which day of the week you came into the facility, you would see the same physicians and nurse assistants and so forth. The staffing plan, scope and scheduling, and then inclusion of mental health and women's health services, that was a big part of the ask for us, and both vendors came forward with solutions for that. So we're very pleased, as you mentioned earlier, that's been a great concern. That was one of those themes that emerged through those stakeholder meetings. And so the contract will include a mental health professional on staff for a half day each day. So that's a good, going to be a great asset to the university. I also had a real strong strength marketing approach and abilities. And again, something that emerged through that the RFP process was creating a joint advisory committee to make sure that there's constant communication between the university and our healthcare provider to make sure that we're staying current with what the needs of the students are, how those needs are being addressed, and providing those services to the student body. There's also participation in the Campus Partners Program, which again will be a behavior, mental health behavioral specialist. That's a program that is a group of staff that meet on a regular basis to identify potential challenges that students may be having in the intervention methods. And so having that person be a part of that process is going to be very valuable to us. There are also some value adds that the Med Center is bringing in addition to what we were asking for within the RFP itself. Their proposal includes providing physical therapy services on campus, and that'll be open to the entire WKU community as a whole. Consultation to manage infectious diseases, and I want to take a moment here to say that this is in line with what we're doing with managing the pandemic, with the work that we did with Graves Gilbert. And I do want to take a moment to thank Graves Gilbert for the work that they did. And the support that they've given us through the years that they've managed our on-campus health services. I don't think anything about selecting MedCenter Health going forward should reflect badly on what Graves Gilbert has done for us in the past. They've been a very strong partner. It's just that at this point in time and what we were asking for through the RFP, MedCenter Health was able to meet that ask better. The electronic patient portal with an app, so MedCenter Health is bringing to us technical abilities that allows us to meet the students where they are, living in the digital world. So any patient with MedCenter Health will be able to access medical records, schedule appointments, message providers, all of that within through the phone and the apps. They're also offering telemedicine as a visitation type when it's appropriate, with access to MedCenter Health network of resources to meet patient needs. And that's outside of what's provided on campus. But if there are any referrals that are off campus for services that are not provided on campus, then the patient will have the choice of providers for all of that. So nobody's required to use MedCenter Health just because we have MedCenter Health on campus. Patients will still have the choice of providers for any of those referrals. One of the asks within our RFP was really what can this vendor bring to us to be a strategic partner with WKU to help us achieve our goals in promoting student success as a whole. And so MedCenter Health has a long history of working with us in terms of our nursing programs, our physical therapy program, and providing preset programs for medical students, and they will continue to do so. Also, continuation of clinical opportunities for exercise science and nutrition students. But there are also opportunities to develop formal programs beyond what they're doing today, so that could include public health. And it could include other non-healthcare programs, marketing, accounting. There are some, behind-the-scenes kind of things that our students, could feed into those experiences as well. And so anytime that we're talking with vendors, we're looking for these opportunities to provide applied learning opportunities for students. And certainly MedCenter Health will be able to do that as well. The contract terms itself, the initial contract is for 10 years with renewal options up to additional 5 years. It specifies a standard of care expected based on a mutual understanding of the RFP and MedCenter Health's response to that. and it formalizes partnership to assist with mental health and behavioral health issues. It also establishes expectations to provide professional development to adapt to the changing needs of our students moving forward. And you can imagine, you know, just sitting here 5 years ago, we would not have predicted a pandemic and within that timeline. And so we recognize that sitting here today, we can't predict what the next year, next 10 years holds for us. But certainly with changes in technology, with changes in the profession, we would expect to see our vendor continue to adapt to those changes. It also leverages MedCenter Health resources to meet the healthcare needs of the campus community, strategically assist WKU with cost-saving efforts, and provide student-applied learning opportunities. So all of that is included in the contract language, which you've seen. It also creates a mechanism to adjust services and operations through a mutual agreement, and that will be through that joint advisory committee that we discussed earlier. But it also creates an out clause, which allows initiation from either party for cause. Requires written notice of any breach and then a time period to remedy such breach. And if we're not able to come to a mutual agreement, then it allows for 180 days to make a transition to another provider. That's an unusually long time when it comes to contractual terms. However, given the complexity of the services that are provided, it's very important. And it's also important that any change occur prior to the start of a fall or a spring semester when we have most of our students on campus. And then just kind of a big picture, you know, some of the early feedback was concerns, you know, about making a change and what does that mean for people who are providing, you know, have providers with Graves Gilbert. Patients who are currently with Graves Gilbert who would like to continue to do so or welcome to do so, they'll just follow their doctors to their new offices. But anybody who would like to transfer to MedCenter Health as their primary care provider is able to do that and ask to transfer their records. And I mentioned earlier that any referrals beyond, you know, if you're meeting with MedCenter Health and the on-site facility, that any referrals would maintain that patient choice moving forward. So those are the contract highlights, and I'll open the floor to questions and comments.
Well, I'll have a few comments. First of all, I think there's a lot to like about it, particularly the mental health and all the opportunities it gives to collaborate on our programs. I think that's good. We only have one real proposal in front of us, so you know, you work with what you have. On the other hand, I'm daily privy to the underbelly of healthcare. I think it'll be really important for us to keep an eye on quality, and that advisory committee or whoever, we need to have somebody keep an eye on that. And this gives us a real chance to do a little consumer education, public education, which is part of our role as a university, in terms of cost of healthcare. And one of the things that happened in Congress a couple of years ago is they forced all providers to give a list of charges and costs. And I'm sorry to say most physicians have no idea about what things cost. This is the most expensive thing in healthcare. It's what doctors order. And many times that's fairly cavalierly. So I think we should make some effort to be sure that people understand what costs are, whether they're in our facility or whether they're being transferred out to some other facility for a scan or whatever. And that data is out there available, and we should make it public information so that people can become better consumers. It's no secret that we spend twice as much for healthcare in America, and yet when it comes to chronic disease management, we're at the bottom. We rank 27 out of 27 of industrialized countries in our results. We do a terrible job because we don't do prevention. We pay for bad care, which typically occurs in hospitals and nursing homes and physician offices. So I look at this as an opportunity where we can maybe enlighten the public and move the needle a little bit in terms of promoting a better healthcare system. A little bit of history behind this, too, that others probably aren't aware of because nobody else was on the board at the time. But prior to Graves Gilbert taking over, the university ran it to the tune of losing over $1 million a year. It was coming out of our budget. And so when that move was made, and now this move was made, everybody needs to realize we're saving a ton of money over what used to be. So that's a good thing. It also provides a good opportunity for data collection. Somebody do a really good research project on some of this stuff. And I hope someone in the university will grab on to that, because I think we could probably do some pretty interesting stuff. So those are my comments.
I'm excited about this partnership. I think with the expansion of services that the Med Center is going to bring, I think it's a win-win for students. So I really appreciate your work on this, Dr. James.
Thank you so much for all your work, your committee's work, Susan's work. I know a lot of work went into this, and it does look very exciting. But it's going to be great for our students.
I'll just chime in. Thank you for the effort. This is a long time coming. But I'm also pleased with the process we employed, which is going out and getting an objective third party to guide us in the creation of the RFP, to help us find expertise to shape that in such a way that we get, maximize what we get out of a contract. Again, I'm thankful that you were able to preserve in this physician choice and portability and all the things that are important for our faculty, staff, and students. The thing I learned is that the majority of visits are to our health clinic. And as you can imagine, with a young population, it's a great deal of treatment for either infections or viruses. It's kind of normal, run-of-the-mill things. There are some STI treatments that are important that we deliver here. Doing a lot of shots, and that's a good thing, and that not a lot of major issues come through that door, and I would say the same thing for our faculty and staff. It's very much operates like an urgent care facility, more so than a typical physician's office. That's good. I think the place where we can continue to grow is around health, wellness, prevention, so that we can grow the health of our community, which long-term also brings down health costs and creates better lives for everyone. So thank you for all.
The mental health piece of this is
absolutely.
You could have three people in every day. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't fill that need. But
and Philip, to that point, the hope is that we do not currently have just able to do prescriptions, but that this will hopefully be able to allow that to occur on campus. So again, a third of our students are medicated. We prefer them to do that through a doctor's office instead of self-medicating, and that would be an important service for us to have available.
Even though the process has been long, it's been good.
Dr. Logan has been toying, with ideas about, how can we strengthen that aspect of it, and certainly Dr. Crowe, counseling, was heavily involved in this process and really emphasizing the mental health piece of what we're doing moving forward, and so there's definitely opportunities for growth.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I need to recuse on this.
being on the board of an affiliated organization.
Okay. Due to my relationship with
Do we have a motion to approve the health services contract?
So moved.
Second.
Any further discussion? And all in favor? All opposed? Very good. The motion passes. And then I think, Jennifer, you have for our action item 7, you're also going to talk about the approval of the health services lease.
Yes, ma'am. Certainly, a part of providing those services is where those services will be provided. And Med Center Health will be moving into the health services building in the space currently occupied by Grace Gilbert. The lease itself parallels the contract in terms of the length of the length of the lease. The amount of the lease per year will be $177,000 per year with a biennial 2% increase beginning in January of 2024, and they will be making monthly payments for that. The lease amount includes utilities, maintenance, operations, custodial services for public spaces, and the tenant will be responsible for cleaning treatment rooms and for disposal of hazardous waste. Telecommunications and parking are separate. But the patient parking is shared within the clinical services lot itself, and that is included in the lease. There are insurance requirements to name WKU as an additional insured. And it also contains provisions for a hold harmless clause. Any steps needed to modify the facility will go through our planning, design, and construction office. And then remedies to WKU for damage, default, or holdover. They're also termination language that mirrors the contract. So. And a note about construction, they are fully aware that they will have a new neighbor at some point in the future over the College of Business, and that the parking lot at the very least will be affected aside from the noise and dust, but they've assured me that they're familiar with construction. So that's the highlights of the lease itself.
Any questions or comments about the lease?
Just a touch of using it for the site.
Okay. Okay. All right, thank you. Do we have a motion to approve the lease?
So moved.
Second.
Any further discussion? Okay. To go to vote then, all in favor of the lease, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
I think your dog's against it. or was that the baby?
Okay, the motion passes for the lease. And finally, our last action item is approval of Parking Structure 3 rooftop lease.
This is actually give you a brief history in time. When the first year of Village project began, Barnes Campbell Hall was targeted as a building to come down, which meant that AT&T needed a new home for their cell tower. At that time, we created a temporary lease for them top of Tower B of Parking Structure 3 to buy us a little time to work with the Master Plan Committee to find a permanent location for an independent tower. We were not able to come to a mutually agreeable location elsewhere on campus. As you can imagine, there are a number of factors that have to go into site selecting where telecommunications equipment can live. And in the end, it was decided that leaving things where they were was the best course of action. So the lease before you converts a temporary lease in for AT&T, and that's a picture of their equipment sitting on top of the parking structure, as you can see it today. And the term is 10 years with two automatic five-year options to extend. The lease amount is $39,000 for year one with a 3% increase each calendar year thereafter. It does allow for adjustments due to utility inflation costs or increased demand if it exceeds thresholds. There's
any questions? Any questions about the lease or comments? I'd like to have a motion for approval of the rooftop lease.
So moved.
Second. All right. Any further discussion? We'll move to a vote to approve the lease. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion passes. And I apologize, I had said that was the last item on the agenda, but there was a new item added, as we discussed earlier, and this is FB9, approval of a one-time payment to certain employees.
So as the president mentioned earlier when we started this kind of long agenda, is that this was added at the kind of the last minute yesterday. We received a recommendation from the Budget Executive Committee, I guess yesterday or late, the day before. So this is, this is approval for a one-time payment to employees. We are recommending a $950 one-time payment for employees hired on or before July 1, 2022, with an annual salary less than or equal to $65,362. So as board members, you might ask why and how did you come up with that number? That was the BEC recommendation, and this is the faculty median salary across campus. I put that note on there earlier today. We're currently working on a lot, as you might imagine, there's a lot of issues around implementing a salary adjustment to a large number of people. We were ever so hopeful that we might be able to get it into the December payroll, but most of that work has already been completed. So most likely, unless a miracle happens later today, it would probably most likely come in January. But we are working with Andrea and our HR professionals on any guidelines, anything about who's eligible, who's not eligible, so on and so forth. So that is the recommendation. I think this is great news for campus, and I'm excited to recommend it, and I know the president probably has a few questions.
Thankful that we got to this place. You will recall we began this conversation this summer when we talked about the 2% increase. There was some question around can we do a one-time payment given the treating inflation pressures, and BEC worked throughout the course of the semester with various options and opportunities. And I think this is a terrific example of the way in which the new budget process works. Sometimes it's painful. Sometimes there's a give and take. Sometimes there's a lot of take and no give. Sometimes there's all give and no take. But at the end of the day, what happened is a group of faculty, staff, administrators, colleagues took off their individual hats as faculty members, staff members, administrators, and worked to do something that's in the best interest of our faculty and staff, particularly those who are most needy of this inflation support. And so, I'm thankful for the work of the BEC. I think it's a tremendous example of how shared governance actually works, even though it can be messy at times. And I heartily recommend passing this. And while I wish we could get it done before the holidays, we can make the impossible happen on occasion, but this is one that might be too heavy a lift. But I'm glad it will be there after.
I really applaud this gesture. I want to personally thank the members of the BEC. I've been involved in some of this process, though not directly. I'm not a member of the BEC, but there are three members of the staff senate that sit in that group, and we appreciate the diligence of the entire committee in weighing this over and over again, finding a good middle ground to resolve this. I can't say enough, though, also about Susan's office, Ronaldo, on his first day back. Brian Denning, of course, and Susan, you all have been great in dealing with it. And I know that this came up very suddenly. And also the very patient people in the payroll office, Christy Smith, Vicki Heater, and Sherry Taylor. I can't say enough about I know that came as a pretty sudden shock, and we understand the complications related to payroll and how once you put something in motion, it's difficult to turn that ship around. So we are all very grateful for this help for those people that are qualified to receive it. And I think it's an outstanding, more than just a gesture, I think it's a good mechanism to help with some relief. So thank you.
I'd just like to echo Regent Franklin's comments, and then also, you know, one of the questions that we get all the time is the difference between one-time money versus recurring revenues and helping people understand what we can and can't do with that, as you alluded to earlier. And so I know we started the call on this board in our May meetings about what can we do with inflation that did not seem as transitory as Chairman Powell was telling us at the time, and has proven not to be. So again, I'd like Regent Franklin to applaud the BEC for recognizing that we have people on this campus who can definitely benefit from this and finding a way to make that happen.
And to Regent Spiller's comments, there are trade-offs, right? And so I'd be remiss if I didn't explain that this is a decision made today that in future years will reduce our budgetary flexibility, reduces days of cash on hand by a day and a half, and so that has long-term implications. But what better time than once-in-a-generation inflationary event that we should be able to support our people and do what we can to take care of them. So it's why we've worked so hard at the campus to create fiscal stability, and this is the outcome of that, the ability to do things like this when necessary.
Ask for a motion to approve the one-time payment.
So moved.
Second. Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion passes.
Chair West.
Yes.
Before we move on, didn't you have some, speaking of fiscal responsibility, some other news you could share with us today? No, not yet.
No.
Okay.
Yes, we do. We have a introduction of our new internal auditor who's here with us today.
Okay, so I am pleased and extremely happy to introduce our new director of internal audit, Bruce Wiseman. Bruce was selected as our new director after an extensive national search. Some of his highlights, he's a certified internal auditor as well as a certified public accountant. He began his accounting career in public accounting and then began working internal audit at Vanderbilt in 2010. And he has spent the last 4 years at Vanderbilt as associate director of internal audit, so just next in line to director. And he is very experienced in annual risk assessment and audit planning. So I'm extremely happy to have Bruce on board. I know you as a board and a president, he will report to you guys. I will help with some of the administration of sick and vacation leave and things like that, and he will certainly be part of our team to interact and those type of things, but he is your report and, I guess, a dotted line to the president. So I will introduce Bruce and let him speak to the board if you'd like.
As a historical context, again, this is still a relatively new position. We did not have our internal auditor until the last 5 years. And to give all of us more comfort and ability to sleep well at night.
I think that's the...
I couldn't have said it better myself.
I'm happy to be here. I'm excited to be here at Western Kentucky. I'm very excited. The direction that President Cavone is taking the university. I'm excited to work with Susan and her team. Everyone has been wonderful that I've met so far and has been very welcoming, which you don't always get with an auditor. So I appreciate that, and I look forward to working with you all and speaking with you all in my new role. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Chair Bale and I had an opportunity to meet Bruce, and I don't know if Gary did or not, but we're very impressed with you and very happy to have you on board.
Thank you all very much.
Okay. That is all the business of the finance committee.
Let's take a 7-minute break.
It's 2:45.
in person now has the opportunity to complete phase one of DLI within that course, which has been very beneficial, I think, to the program itself, but also to reaching out to more students about student activities programming outside of maybe who students who may normally just come to our office want to get involved. Now we have a little bit more outreach into the classroom as well. So each phase does have a set curriculum that we have within the program, and students also have the choice if they want to try it out, maybe just do phase one within a semester. There's not an obligation to move forward through each phase, but it is a good, I always tell students during master plan or if we're tabling, if you want to get involved on campus, it's like a good way to get your feet wet, see what's going on, meet new students. The time commitment for students is usually the sessions are about an hour long, and they meet 5 or 6 times within the semester. So it's about a 5 or 6 hour commitment for our students. And I won't go through the nitty-gritty of the curriculum for each phase, but within the first phase, students usually get general information about personality assessments. They'll take the color personality quiz. Some of you all may have done that in some of your office development. We also have a problem-solving activity. It's a murder mystery, students typically love that one. And then there's some other ones talking about leadership style. We also have an introspective identity program, which focuses more on our diversity, equity, and inclusion within our leadership trainings. Moving into phase two, it's more personality assessments, more team-building activities. Students get to know each other a little bit better that way. And then moving into phase three, the students will take what they have learned in phases one and two about themselves and start to apply it to their leadership practices on campus or in the community. So for example, in phase three, which Chase participated in this semester, so he'll talk more about that later, but students have the opportunity to do a community service project or a cultural immersion experience. So that could be volunteering as a group, they're placed in groups, volunteering, maybe doing a collection drive for somewhere in the community, or it might be going to a cultural experience on campus. So one of our groups this semester went to an event from OLAS, which is the Hilltopper Organization of Latin American Students, and went to an event for Dia de los Muertos and presented about that. So that's our phase three. And then going into phase four, it's more resume workshopping, mock interviews. There's a session on financial success. And then they get the chance to go to 440 downtown and have an etiquette dinner, which is provided by our office as well. So I alluded to this a little bit, but now the question is, who participates in DLI? We have first-year students all the way up to graduate students who participate in the program. So it's a very broad range. I would say maybe first-year sophomores is our largest pool of participants, but we do have a broad range. Like I mentioned earlier, our LEAD 200 courses, these are one of the courses that we worked with this semester, participated in the phase one this year. We also work very closely with the social work department and provide the curriculum within the classroom. And then we also recruit heavily through Greek Life, through Master Plan, and then also sometimes at the beginning of the semester we'll do classroom presentations to recruit for the program that way. Also, you may notice here there's red towels. At the end of phase one, participants receive a red towel that says the Dynamic Leadership Institute, which is a fun memento and incentive to participate and then continue through the phases. So just these are a few photos here that you might observe. I mentioned that Dia de los Muertos presentation. That is the photo at the bottom left there. But students who participate in DLI also do tend to stay pretty involved within student activities programming or maybe elsewhere on campus if they meet someone through the program. So one good story I actually had this week was there were two students who I facilitated in phase one of DLI in one of the LEAD 200 courses this semester. And a few weeks ago, I was facilitating, and I said, oh, our office also offers alternative spring break trips. If you're interested in applying, we're going to go to Washington, D.C., and then another group to Charleston. So two of the students from that course came to my office. They're going to the Charleston spring break trip. They became friends in their Lead 200 course. They said that they think DLI helped them get to know each other a little bit better in the class, and now they're participating in alternative spring break. So that's just one example of how we get students a little bit more involved that way. These are just more numbers from DLI. This is just for fall 2022. So this semester we had, in phase one, 164 students. So that was a pretty big group. We had a lot of kind of different opportunities for phase one. We also offer about once a semester a DLI in a day. So if a student can't commit to meeting multiple weeks, we'll pick a Saturday that students can come and do all sessions of phase one within one day. In phase two, we had 44 students, phase three, 41, and phase four, 11 students a semester. Now, Morgan might take over here in just a second, but just to kind of give some background. So Morgan Helton, she began the Dynamic Leadership Institute program when she was a freshman here at WKU, and she did all four phases back to back. So she had completed the program by the end of her sophomore year, and she wanted to stay involved with the program. So she decided that she wanted to facilitate a session and got a group of women from her sorority, Kappa Delta, together and has been facilitating them. This semester, they just completed phase three together. So now I'm going to turn it over to Morgan, let her talk a little bit more about her experience with DLI and anything else she wants to add.
Yeah, so like Amelia said, I started DLI my freshman year, so in fall of 2019. And so I wasn't involved in my sorority at the time. I didn't go through recruitment or anything yet. So I wasn't involved in campus at all, really. And so that was kind of my first experience actually having some kind of sense of belonging on campus. And so I met people in even my first phase that I still am in contact with today. So I finished all the courses, and I had a really good time in all my phases. I would go into a phase not knowing literally anyone and then befriending a couple people. And then after I finished up, I saw like how much it had benefited me. Even just like, I didn't even have a resume. I mean, now it's pushed more so like when you're a freshman, but back then, like, I didn't even have a resume. I didn't have any kind of direct like leadership classes or anything. So then I finished up, and then I worked with Amelia and some of the other people in the office and was like, you know, I'd like to facilitate some of the girls in my sorority. So then I started that would have been last fall I started phase one. We had about probably 30 or 40 young women in that, and then now I think I just finished up phase three with about 25-ish women, and I think that they've really enjoyed it. I think they're even more passionate about it because they already knew each other, so they're more open to conversation, and like it's very easy to apply it to, you know, real life examples for them personally. So they just finished up, and the community service projects were awesome. Like Amelia touched on, we did that in phase three. A couple of them did as simple as just like going and volunteering at the Humane Society or donation drives. Stuff like that. One of the girls is from Florida and lives in the town, I can't remember the name of it, where Hurricane Ian hit. And so they did a drive of just like food, animal stuff, water, literally everything, and they collected a bunch of stuff. And so she was taking that down over break. So it's awesome how I feel like they've learned a lot of real life experiences through it. And as a facilitator, I feel like I learned, after going through the material again on the other side of things, I feel like I still got such a big benefit just from not just being a participant, but also really experiencing it. So,
yeah. And also in these photos here, I put these here just, so this was her phase one group that Morgan facilitated last fall, so fall of 2021. And then that photo in the top right was from this semester. Their phase three group received some pad folios to take to interviews, but that was her group. So it's kind of, you can see over the past year, her group evolved together. And then now I'm going to turn the floor over to Chase. You can just share generally your DLI experience and what it has meant to you.
Yes, ma'am. So I joined DLI when I came here and started Western fall of 21. And I joined Greek Life. I joined Sigma Alpha Epsilon. And so I knew a bunch of guys just from getting involved there. And a bunch of us wanted to get more involved. So we started DLI phase one. and none of us knew what we were going to expect, but going into it, we like just went in with an open mind, and there was fun activities. We were always like comparing what we got with each other, like the answers on like the color quiz, like all that stuff. Like it was just super fun, and we met a bunch of other people in Greek life and that weren't in Greek life. And then after phase one, I was like, you know, I want to do phase two. So a few more of us went to phase two, and I just thought I've stuck with it because of how fun and how much you learn. Like within like being a leader, you don't know how much of like a leader you can be until you go through and like have these like scenarios you have to answer and talk about and discuss. And like working with a team of a bunch of people that want to be a leader, you just all start clicking and coming up with answers, and it's like it's super fun. I've never had a dull moment in DLI, which is meeting people, making new connections. And then phase three, we had to do a project. We went to the first generation student that was held in DSU. That was super cool to learn about like all the like programs Western offers to help first generation students. And then along with that, just getting to know more about everything about the first generations, and then hearing what all my other colleagues did. Like the other day was more, the Chai Chat that one group did. It was just super cool to hear about everything, and it was awesome. And I can't wait for phase four. DLI has been awesome so far.
And Chase actually came to me about a week or so ago and said he wants to facilitate a group as well. So hopefully he'll be one of the peer leaders within the program in semesters to come. So thank you all. I think that kind of wraps up the general information we had for you all. But if you have any questions, the three of us and Charlie as well are open to any questions you may have.
Just real quickly, I'm happy to see, as a 1986 graduate of Somerset High School, you may have gone to Pulaski, right?
I did go to Pulaski.
You played soccer.
Yes.
You were part of a team that shut out Somerset 9-0. And you scored one of those goals.
Yeah.
Can you forgive me?
I have a quick question for Todd.
Okay.
Can you, in describing this, whatever remarks you're going to make, sort of speak to the overall health of the HAF? I know that's a question that comes up sometimes.
Yes, sir. Glad to. I guess, first of all, with respect to the two contracts, like we discussed at the committee meeting, I think continuity is important when things are going well. You know, women's basketball is certainly, from a win-loss standpoint, it's not going to I really feel good about where they're headed in terms of the overall talent that we have and the youth on the roster and men's basketball. Similar thing, I mean, 7-1 this year, and I think this is the most talented roster that stands for his hand. So I feel like continuity in both these cases is the right thing to do. In terms of HAF, among the many roles that they serve, is they're also the funding mechanism for any growth that we have in athletics outside of the state budget. And they do that in a couple of ways. One is traditional fundraising, generating private dollars. The other is there's a premium on some season tickets that you pay a premium in order to, which is industry-wide. And so that's the money that they generate. And then that goes into really a lot of student-athlete areas. In the the last 3 to 4 years, we've invested significantly in sports medicine, mental health, strength and conditioning, nutrition, advising, and career development in all areas that are actually funded by money that HAF has generated. On the other side, they also help our growth in coaching salaries, help us remain competitive in that. So any growth that we have in coaching salaries or retention bonuses or anything of that nature.
So, action item one. Do I hear a motion?
So moved.
Second. A motion and a second for approval of action item one, which is approval of the addendum to the athletic contract for the head women's basketball coach. Any further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Like sign. Motion passes. Second item is addendum to the head men's basketball contract. Do I hear a motion? Regent Thomas and a second. Regent Brinkley. Further discussion. Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Like sign. Motion passes. We have a few information items. One that we didn't put down, Mr. President, you might want to just briefly touch on your recent meeting in Atlanta, which is a pretty important first step toward reaccreditation.
Well, I'll begin with, I have a visual aid here. Not drop this. So some of you may know that we are a member of ASCU, which is the Association of American State Colleges and Universities, about 400 universities across the nation that are similar to WKU in complexity and makeup. And this year, we were fortunate enough to apply, submit, and be selected as the inaugural recipient of the Diversity, Equity, Inclusion Leadership Award. It's the first time it's been given by ASCU. And I'm proud that we've been recognized for the One WKU campaign. So some of you remember that this campaign began in the summer of 2000 with a pilot project that included faculty, staff, and students looking at DEI issues on the campus. We were in tough times in the nation with what was happening in Louisville, the middle of a pandemic. And we wanted to make sure we created an opportunity to welcome everyone inclusively on this campus who studies, works, visits. And what we've done is that and then some. We created a new micro-credential in the Inclusive Teaching Academy, where we have a workplace cultural competency certificate, both endorsed by the state of Kentucky and CPE, and I'd like to say both of the first in Kentucky as well. So really proud of that. One of the reasons we were awarded this is because most institutions will create a vice president for diversity, equity, inclusion, have some small committee, and check the box. As an institution, we're committed to creating significant and lasting change. And the only way you do that is by having the entire organization willing to be self-critical and work together across all of our institutional silos. And just that, there are committees across the university, colleges, and other units that make sure we're being attentive to issues and working on equity inclusion. Now, the other thing I will say, and my perspective on this work is that, yes, it's about diversity, equity, inclusion, but it's not about programs. It's really about one thing, making sure that every person who comes to our campus, they come to study, they come to do research, they come to teach, they come to compete, they come just as visitors. I want every person not just to find their place, but to feel a true sense of belonging. I want to congratulate Molly Kirby and Michael Crow, who went to the ASCU meeting to receive the award and represent the university. And I'm really proud of the strides that we've made and what is to come. Because for us to be successful as an institution, we have to continue to get better on every metric and
one of those is making sure every person who wants to be here finds their place. So with that, Molly and Michael, if you have anything you'd like to add, put you on the spot, because that's a fun thing to do.
I just that we've been a member of ASCII for so many years, and we actually were in on the American Democracy Project and was part of it then. I really think that we're such a good fit, and we're a leader in ASCII, and it's just another token of that we have.
And I think to echo Dr. DeBoney's point about how we work across the aisles, how we work with faculty, staff, students alike to make this happen. I think that's true. How we accomplish what we accomplish. Collaboration and working in a group to make sure that we're all part of the decisions and what's going on here at WKU.
So a frequent question that I get, which is, I would argue, an uninformed critique, is why don't you have a single vice president for diversity? And the answer to that is because when you make it one person's responsibility, it lets everybody else off the hook, number one. And number two, for the work to be successful, we needed to be student-focused, but also faculty-focused. And so having a foot in each side of the organization is really terrific for us. The last thing I'll say, the last time we were recognized nationally was in 2014 for student-centered work by ASCII, similar award. And so it's been 8 years, but really proud to present to the Board of Regents on behalf of the university this recognition.
Comments?
Deb, congratulations, great recognition. Dr. Boyd and I have had a number of conversations about this, and I know there have been some alumni that have raised issues about what we are doing and our success, and I think this is just another example of what we are doing, and that I think highlights how far we've come. And actually, probably what we're doing better than some of the much larger schools in the state. So I think it's a
problem. Thank you, George.
I didn't mention any names. But great job.
Thank you.
In no small measure, in part from the George and C.J. Nichols investment in our campus. Martha.
And I do want to acknowledge, I know that I've been notified that some of you regents have contributed to this Monday scholarship program, and I want to thank everyone for that. But again, it's just another example. There's so much great things going on there. We believe in it, we'll always believe in it, and committed to helping for us to grow the university. It really makes it a big impact. Thank you.
And the related, on a related note, this will be on the agenda in January. We began long before this week, last weekend, the process of reaffirmation of our accreditation from SAC COC, the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools. This is a tremendous undertaking. It happens once a decade. You may recall we had our 5-year re-up a few years ago. The site visit is in spring of 2025. Our off-site report is in fall of 2024, but the work has already begun, and it is an activity that requires the entire university community to come together to be self-critical, but also to talk about what we've managed to accomplish together since the last reaccreditation. It also is an opportunity for us to think about how it is we do a quality enhancement project that will help make us even better, and hopefully is aligned, from my perspective, to the strategic plan. And the final document, it's not really a document anymore, winds up being this size, and then we'll have peers come visit campus all along the way asking challenging questions. And at the end, we hope that we get through it with flying colors. And it's an important activity. Accreditation signals to the community high quality, and for us, it's a chance to really do some reflection and self-assessment in a way that can continue to advance the institution. So you will hear more in January, but it was we have a great team working on it. Bud and Susan obviously do some heavy lifting. Beth Lavis will be on point for the institutional part of it and assembling everything and making sure she's our liaison with Zach's. Rob Hale, who had been doing that, also is going to play an important role, and it continues out of that as well with registrar, and essentially this will touch every part of our institution. It is a heck of an effort if you've ever been through one. It is a stressful time because you want to make sure you dot the I's, cross the T's. But we've got a terrific team, and the process has begun in earnest in January. We kick it off with you all, but really start deepening the involvement of the entire campus.
Very good. Our last information item is something everyone has, I think, a copy in front of them. This is the annual synopsis, really, of the Board of Regents evaluation of the president. And I have formulated this statement with some kind input from Regent Nichols and Regent Milliken, who were both kind enough to give me a helping hand in this, and this will be disseminated for public consumption. Anyone that wishes to read it, and that will be submitted into our minutes today. And that is the last item on our agenda. We have some notifications for next year's meetings. These tend to get carved in stone, although sometimes we'll change one if circumstances dictate, but people should go ahead and put that on their calendars and assume that those will be the dates of the meetings we have next year. The last
one last thing. Okay. In terms of the evaluation, I want to thank the board for their continued confidence and for the comments. Casey and I are blessed to be in these roles and continue to be energized and thankful and proud of the work and the accomplishments, not of ourselves, but of the whole team. And so while I appreciate the continued vote of confidence, I also want to congratulate the cabinet, the deans, my office staff, everyone who works to advance the institution. While the presidency is highly visible, for better or for worse, I'm glad to be the face of the work of so many. And so with that, I appreciate the positive review, but also want to thank everyone else who makes that possible. So to my colleagues, heartfelt thank you. Continue to be excited, energized, and look forward to continuing the good hard work and progress with WKU.
All right. With that, see, I don't think I have a motion. Let's throw a motion
let's
out.
Let's do it.
Who wants to move that we adjourn?
Move to adjourn.
Norris. Who say? All right, I have a motion and a second to adjourn. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, like say. Thank you.